Blog Talk Radio. Happy 4th of July holiday, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Marvin Gowan, Chuck Thurston, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey, Paula.
Hey, good morning, Paula. Good morning, Chuck. Good morning,
morning.
Marvin.
Hey.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Paula. Go ahead.
No, you say it, Marvin. We were having a great conversation, right?
we were talking about mind circuitry, you know, and how different it would be up in the Mandarin worlds versus what we have now. And it's just like, it's a little, sometimes it's a little difficult to transition to, oh, yeah, here we are in Cosmic Citizen. Welcome. Where are we?
Where are we again? Oh, hello. But you know what tickles me about that is that it takes nothing for us to go to a very deep place very quickly in terms of a conversation. And it reminded me of what our dear friend Diane said, sent us an email last week, and she was so complimentary and so beautiful. She's such a dear friend, and she said, "You guys just volley to one another. You have the best time expounding off of one another, and it's just really so great to hear." And I thought about that when we had to all of a sudden move into the Cosmic Citizen from the Mansion Worlds, where we were speculating about what it must be like to have a new Marantia mind in the 10 minutes before the show started. And it was a really fun speculation, and we seem to be able to do that pretty easily. So it's great. Thank you.
Well, we
it's
act like it, it's something pretty profound, but really, isn't it just the Wizard of Oz and the Tin Man singing, "If I only had a brain"?
That's so true. And I actually made that correlation with the Wizard of Oz that we were talking about waking up on the Mansion Worlds and what that's like, what that must be like, because you have your new mind and how you process things, all those new senses And I said, maybe it's like, you know, when she opens the door to the Land of Oz and it goes from black and white to Technicolor. And it's something like that, you know, all of a sudden everything is in high def, amazing colors we've never imagined before. That's the way I think about it, you know, senses that we've never had. We're taking in information on so many levels. And we were talking about how that, you know, at least we have help learning to navigate that. So,
yeah. Well, you know, and the specific help I was thinking of are the Marantia companions.
Right.
It's so, you know, we read, you know, in the universe that companionship is always provided. We struggle with that here. I mean, it's DIY as usual, you know. You got to find your own companions. But on the higher levels, they always make tended to socially, which I think is very interesting that that becomes such a priority and that this is provided so generously. The whole order of being, just even Havona, there's Havona companions, right? And on the Madison worlds, there are Marantia companions. So they'll help us with our early orientation as we get used to having all this new equipment. In a very loving way, sure, yeah. Not without humor and grace.
You know, if you sort of think about what will be different between our circumstances here and now and our circumstances upon awakening on the Mansion Worlds, and it's like, where do you start? There's so many things, the fundamental things that are going to be different, right? And one of them is the very mechanism we use to process reality and to be conscious, meaning our mind structure, our mind function, will be a different mind structure. It'll be a Marantia mind circuitry, which will function radically differently in many ways than our current biochemically-based mind structure. And then we're going to be in a dramatically different environment, a Marantia environment with Marantia beings. And the first beings that we will see upon opening our little Marantia eyes, I know, I love thinking about that, is our wonderful guardian angels. That's what they say.
I know.
Is that the first beings that will greet us are these angels that have been with us our whole lives as our companions. Mm. And who love us so much and who we love so much, but we've never seen them physically, you know, in any direct sense. So we're going to see them immediately, and we're going to be able to hear immediately the voice of the adjuster that has been so subtle and so sort of difficult to discern in this life. We're going to hear that voice directly. And what it relates to, and this is the interesting thing about kind of the conversations that the four of us have, for me, is, you know, because of this revelation, we can think about and anticipate these things really with great delight to anticipate them and talk about them. And as a result, we form a mini culture, and in this movement, we have a culture. And it's so different from any other culture in
how
the broader culture
be?
That surrounds us. Yeah, because there's so much detailed information that we have to work with in our frame of reference, the way we think and what we think about, that is so different from the commonplace way of thinking that, I mean, I think Dion is right. You know, we get together and it's almost endless exploration of all these possibilities and realities that are quite specialized in a certain way because of our immersion in this revelation. And we really kind of get off on it. It's sort of, it really floats our boat, you know, to talk about this.
Romancing the universe.
Yeah. What you were saying, Chuck, that the social extension of it in our sharing in our group culture is part of the dramatic difference in our each of our individual frames of reference because of the immersion in this revelation. Yeah,
right.
It's just sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, if I could just read one quick paragraph here. This is one of the groups of Marantia companions. There's a bunch of them, but these are called the Pilgrim Receivers and Free Associators. says, these are the social companions of the new arrivals on the Mansion Worlds. One of them will certainly be on hand to welcome you when you awaken on the initial Mansion World from the first transit sleep of time, when you experience the resurrection from the death of the flesh into the Mirage life. And from the time you are thus formally welcomed on awakening to that day when you leave the local universe as a first stage spirit, these Mirage companions are ever with you. So that to me, I just get a really warm feeling with that. So like you're pointing out, Marvin, our seraphim will be there. We'll have a whole new level of engagement with our adjuster. But then there's also going to be like a representative, sort of the life we're heading into. So that idea of being formally welcomed, I like that, you know. I mean, we'll be welcomed by our personal associates, but the idea that the whole regime of the Mansion World also provides a formal welcome, I think that's kind of cool.
That is way cool. And, you know, it is.
Yeah.
It mimics being born so much to me. I mean, the parallels are astonishing, you know, that the first thing you see is the smiling face of your mother and father. You know, you have these angels that are aggressive and retiring. how similar that is to male and female, and
mm-hmm.
You know that how. But for the first time, I keyed in on their joy. It's interesting. While we were having this conversation, it struck me, their joy is so like ours is when our newborn comes into the world. And we get to see it for the first time. We get to see that precious little being
and welcome
in the flesh and welcome them. And what a joy that is, and how everybody in the whole extended family has to come and see and meet that precious one. And what a miracle. We are all touched by this miracle of this child. This human, little tiny human being. and here they are welcoming us as these little tiny Mirage babies.
Mirage babies.
Yeah, Mirage babies. That's so cool to think about. You know, it's a natural feeling, as above, so below. It's, you know, that love. It's like they say, curiosity and the dread of monotony. These weren't put there to aggravate and annoy you. You know, the love of children, the love of new life, the love of the joy of welcoming that new family member. That's not something borrowed or something we made up. That is something in us, innate from our Creator.
Yeah.
You know,
well, to me, I love thinking about this contrast. I mean, they describe these companions, just one line, they describe them as touchingly affectionate and charmingly social. They're touchingly affectionate and charmingly social beings. So, you know, they possess distinct personalities, et cetera. Excuse me. But to be greeted with that kind of spirit, I think, is a really a wonderful thing. You know, coming from a planet like this one, you know. We're not, touchingly affectionate and charmingly social. I mean, we run into that sometimes, but to have that is just in the nature of things on the next world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just how these beings are, you know. And to be able to just relax into that and realize, wow, okay, this is a whole new standard of just day-to-day existence even, which is exciting to think about.
You
know,
it's definitely exciting to think about. I mean, imagine how blessed we are to look at our transition from this life in this way, not with dread and fear of the unknown and, you know, just horror and this teaching that we'll be judged, whatever, you know, but welcomed as much as we welcome a newborn. You know,
yeah.
Who would judge a newborn?
Here are a couple of, you know, while we're sort of, as Andre likes to know, you know, we're in our preamble time here, where we sort of wander wherever we choose to be before we start into our material that's assigned for the day. But here we are talking about this awakening experience, and here are a couple of my favorite paragraphs from the Personality Survival paper. And they say, and when you thus awaken, this is 112.5.21, and when you thus awaken on the mansion worlds of Gerasim, you will be so changed. The spiritual transformation will be so great that were it not for your thought adjuster and the destiny guardian, who so fully connect up your new life in the new worlds with your old life in the first world, you would at first have difficulty in connecting the new Marantia consciousness with the reviving memory of your previous identity. Notwithstanding the continuity of personal selfhood, much of the mortal life would at first seem to be a vague and hazy dream, but time will clarify many mortal associations. So when we wake up, we're in this almost, our previous life is almost like a dream experience, and we're trying to make sense of what we're experiencing with these new this new equipment in many ways. And then they go on to say, the thought adjuster will recall and rehearse for you only those memories and experiences which are a part of and essential to your universe career. If the adjuster has been a partner in the evolution of aught in the human mind, then will these worthwhile experiences survive in the eternal consciousness of the adjuster. But much of your past life, you know, we were talking about memories, Paula, but much of your past life and its memories, having neither spiritual meaning nor Marantia value, will perish with the material brain. Much of material experience will pass away as one-time scaffolding, having bridged you over to the Marantia level. Much of material experience will pass away as one-time scaffolding, which, having bridged you over to the Marantia level, no longer serves a purpose in the universe. But personality and the relationships between personalities are never scaffolding. Mortal memory of personality relationships has cosmic value and will persist. On the mansion worlds, you will know and be known. And more, you will remember and be remembered by your one-time associates in the short but intriguing life on your rancha.
I love that quote. Oh, I love that one so much. Jesus said, lay up your treasures in heaven, and those are your treasures. I just have to throw that in there. Those relationships, those are your treasures.
Yeah.
Because they do last. They do persist. So focus on that. That's what you get to take with you. Work on that, right? Make those rich and beautiful and golden because you get to take them with you. Those are your treasures. At least there's other things that are too that do persist. Memory is one of them, obviously. You know, maybe not all the day-to-day drudgery, but certain memories do go on. They just said that, right? And even there's a place in the book where they tell us that sometimes when they reconstitute certain groups, one person will remember something and then everybody will remember it. I just think that'll be really cool.
Well, and the remembering of relationships is more than just like one person with one other person. It's like even now, as we
groups,
there's a whole network of relationships. So the fact that we remember our relationships means that we can reestablish these networks of relationships that we've developed even during this life. And that's part of the sort of the living fabric of the whole thing, I think, which is why it's so important that we do remember relationships, because that creates this, you know, shared reality that
the
no
ongoing
doubt
team.
Hugely important going forward.
Well, the definition of a person, you know, very interesting the way they define it, how they qualify what a person or a personality is. A person is a being that can know and be known by other persons and can love and be loved by other persons. And obviously there's consciousness, there's awareness in that process. But if you think about it, all of the spiritual or Marantra-laden values, I think I can say this almost without exception, that are part of us, you know, our soul substance, really results as it comes from the experience of living as a person in relationship with other persons, our interactions, our hopes, our plans, our dreams, those that we love, those that we interact with and we spend time with and we learn together. That's why I think this Saturday morning gathering is such a wonderful experience for all of us, and I think for the folks that listen in, is because it really is all about relationships and how we stimulate and enjoy each other's company and stimulate each other to new realization and new experience. It's the stuff of what the universe is made of. I'm really convinced.
That's so
true. It's why God, when God launched the plan of existence, made it relational. I mean, God's first acts were the creation of companions of like level that God could relate to in an associational reality. That's what the universe is. So I think you're right, Chuck. You know, we can't emphasize enough how critically important these relationships are in the fabric of things.
In a way, the substance of relationships is communication. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so interesting about your answer study groups or even this Saturday morning study and all the other things we do too. But they all involve communication, you know, practicing communication. And particularly when it comes to your answer book, just practicing talking about these ideas. It's an important dimension, I think, of our engagement with the book, is to practice our ability to talk about it, right? Because the language and because the book itself is a communication to us. That's kind of what's exciting about it. You have all these celestial authors got together and created this work as a communication to us, you know, trying to share with us a truer perspective on reality, a larger frame for understanding ourselves and God and everything else that we, you know, love so much about your answer book. But to put that as a communication to us, which then we have to practice communicating with each other and then with others that we may know or we'd like to introduce to it, you know, that's a whole big relational communication exercise, you know. Not to cheapen it, but to realize that there is that dimension to it, a dimension of practice and just getting our own grasp on what some of these words mean and what they're talking about, you know. It's exciting and it's fun. But it's a growing thing. It takes, you know, it develops over time, along with the relationships, which is also what makes it cool. So,
well, let me ask you this, you guys: what do you think they when they talk about you'll just forget? What kinds of things do you think you'll just forget? I mean, obviously day to day drudgery, but do you think there's anything that you think is so important right now, you know, that's just earth-shatteringly important? Do you think you'll forget some of that kind of stuff, like politics, for instance? Let's take politics. Do you think you'll forget a lot of that stuff that caused so much conflict and consternation on this world?
Well, you know, the qualifier there is the words, having neither spiritual meaning nor spiritual value. Is the stuff that's scaffolding, right? So the stuff we'll forget doesn't have any continuing worth in terms of spiritual meaning or Marantra value. Now, I think anything with relationships and political stuff and the value, just to take that as an example, right? Political stuff and the values that are embedded and embodied in political realities, which are a form of, you know, cultural, societal, social reality. And you've got law, you've got history, you know, you've got meanings and values as you discern from them. I think those things do have Marantra value, and we will retain them. When I think of things that pass away, I think of really almost mechanical support things, like, you know, brushing my teeth, or, you know, the price of gasoline, or, you know, I mean, that stuff that really has to do with the material reality on our world that was scaffolding and is no longer there up on the mansion worlds. But you know, I think there are things.
Oh, I wouldn't be so sure. So, there might be flossing. You might still have to floss.
There might
I don't
be
know.
Flossing.
I don't know.
Well, I got to tell you, Dave on the board, yes. Brother Dave on the board. Hey, Dave, it's always great to see you today again, and as all of our listeners. And all of the people on the board and regulars. And Dave has been coming the last few weeks, and I love seeing you. He says these are some of the things he thinks, anger, pain, intolerance, and negative self-talk.
that'd be great.
That really intrigues me. Yeah, that'd be great, yeah. I'd love to forget
well,
about
I,
that.
Well, I almost differ. I mean, I respect that, Dave, and you could be right, but I think that there is value in negative object lessons. And I don't think we'll forget those things. I think the things that caused us pain and confusion and created a context where we had to struggle and grow morontally, value-wise, and then climb out of those states and vanquish them, I think that will be part of our experience.
Huh. Because that struggle is part of our spiritual
otherwise,
growth.
What is there to remediate,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
That's
I mean,
true. That's
if we're
true.
Doing remediation, then some of that has to be remembered. You know, I think we need to,
it's the
to
inevitability,
think about
the
it.
Inevitabilities thing.
Yeah, right, exactly. And we need to think about this. I think it's a little easier to get to some of what we remember by looking at some of the mundane things that are going to be very, very important to remember.
Hmm.
Do you think you're going to remember the English language that you're speaking?
Ooh.
Well.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Does it have spiritual
value? You have to.
Value?
How would you communicate
well, yes.
even with yourself? Yeah.
Right. Did you base your thinking on how you spoke in English? If you're bilingual or multilingual, was Spanish important to you? You know, to the extent that you learned it,
mm-hmm.
you know? You know, for me, I have a number of languages at various stages of ill repair, you know, that I speak poorly. But you know what? What does the thought adjuster remember of those and how much value was there? I can share that I saw the thought adjuster working with me in the French language, studying with Québécois readers 10 years ago. You know, when I was studying with Gaétan Charlon and Lynn Saint-Pierre in Saint-Sophie, Quebec. And that was just wonderful to see that, okay, my study of the Aranch book in English and my growing but halting, you know, intermediate level French, the thought adjuster was bringing to mind what I knew was in this section of the book, okay, to associate with the words I was reading and enhancing the experience. It was one of the closest positive adjuster engagement exercises I think I've experienced in this life. So that all to say, those kinds of experiences with the mundane aspects of life, what you learned about colors, what you learned about flavors, what you learned about all of those kinds of things are all significant in this life. But, you know, it underscores Earl Nightingale's thing, which, you know, the famous self-help guru back maybe 20, 30 years ago, who used to say, learn 10 new words every week. There's nothing that will improve your cognition, your station, your success, and even your financial well-being in terms of looking at actual scientifically studied correlation. Nothing will improve your success more and more consistently than improving your vocabulary by 10 words a day, 10 words a week, or however quickly you do so. And so, I mean, there is that element of things, whether you believe that or not, it makes sense from the standpoint when you then reflect on the fact of, you know, the thought adjuster is utilizing whatever he can, you know, to communicate with you. And therefore, you know, the rock bottom of the axiomatic development of concepts in your mind, which is your language, will have to have been developed. So to the extent that you develop that in this life, to that extent, imagine how rich your next life is going to be. Imagine then as well, when they say multiplication of multilinguists is important to the spread of brotherhood on our world, that you doing that makes a difference, however much or little you do. If you're able in a grocery line to be able to say, con permiso, tienes un problema con tu dinero, you know, o algo con you know, sus paquetes, or I'll, you know, if you say something, whatever it is, however mundane it is, in the grocery line, are you having trouble with your money or your packages, you know, in the grocery line, or buenos dias, all of a sudden, you know, you have a tool by which you have engaged somebody that you may not have engaged otherwise. Think about that.
So you know,
language is so important. You're right, Andre. Yeah. Language is invaluable. Go ahead, Martin.
Yes, I think you're right, because language is the medium of interaction between persons.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying. Yeah. I'm trying to think. You know, while you were speaking, I was trying to think, well, okay, what in my life would I think of as scaffolding that I'm not likely to remember? And it took me a while, you know, but I think of things that are simply related to material upkeep. And obviously, I'm not talking about our jobs and our functions and the responsibilities of organizing life well and in a responsible manner, because those have value. I'm talking about things like, let's see, am I going to have yogurt this morning or applesauce? Or maybe I'll have both.
Right.
And should I put my tea in
right.
for 30 seconds or a minute, you know? And oh, dang, I forgot the rest of my
2 minutes is
today,
a lot
you know?
Better.
Yeah. and you know, I come up to a red light. Do I turn right or do I just wait a minute? And, you know, now if there's a person coming and I choose to be gracious to that person, it has value. Otherwise, it doesn't. I'm just mechanically moving through life and getting to the next destination. Those to me are mechanical scaffolding that don't have any spiritual or value component to them.
Mm-hmm.
The use of language and any interpersonal reaction has value. Lasting value, the way we do it and what we accomplish as a result of our interaction with another human being. So yeah, that to me is the criterion, is whether there's a value component to it or whether it's simply a mechanical function that, you know, and it can be in our lives, those mechanical functions can be quite complex because of the civilization we live in, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still, they don't have value components. They're just functional, you know, getting us to the next experience that does have value components. So
sure.
That's how I think about it.
Can I give you some phrases I think might be forgettable in the next life? Here we
sure.
go.
I got a good
sleep.
Joke for you. I got a good joke for you guys. And you guys
okay,
may
sure.
have heard this
Pass
before.
The sleep.
Relates to
Pass
flushing,
the sleep. Is that what,
yeah.
But Andre was going to give us some forgettable phrases. Pass the sleep.
Yeah. Well, it relates.
Pour me another.
Relates
Pour
to
me
the
another.
It relates
I just
to
want
the,
to throw in
to
before that. You tell your joke, Marvin. I just want to say that your comments made me think that what I've thought, I may be doing something very mundane, driving to work, washing the dishes, but I've had some thoughts that I know
yeah.
I will never forget, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some, there's some prayers I've said to God that were at pivotal moments in my life that I know I will never forget. And so going back to language, it's what you know, your thoughts, what you're thinking, you think in language. And there are thoughts I've had that have just, you know, while reading the Urantia book, while contemplating God, that have thrilled me, filled me with wonder. And I will never forget those thoughts, ever. So tell us your joke, Marvin. I just wanted to get that in there.
Well, I almost feel trivial after that, but I agree with you, Paula. I mean, the actual washing of the dishes is the thing that gets left behind. You swirl to the right or swirl to
the
but the experiences you have during that have value, absolutely. Well, relates to Andre's, will we be flossing our teeth in the next life, And I remember hearing this joke about this hellfire brimstone preacher, and he's talking about the next life, and he gets to the peak of his passionate address, and he says, and there will, if it's a tent revival, there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. And way in the back, there's this little old lady who waves her hands wildly, and she says, "But pastor, what if I don't have no teeth?" And the pastor looks at her and says, "Madam, teeth will be provided."
Teeth will be provided to Nash.
That's right.
Getting all that gnashing teeth.
We have to have gnashing.
That's great.
You've got to have gnashing, right?
Teeth will be provided.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, this is maybe a good segue for a special work of the Melchizedek's.
Yeah, let's do it.
Maybe they do provide
early.
Teeth.
Let's go. Yeah.
Who would like to read that one?
Which section is it?
What's
number
the paper
four?
Section?
We're 35, paper 35, section 4, special work of the Melchizedek. Last week we kind of got stuck on the Melchizedek world, as you'll remember. But what a great place to hang out. But yeah, this week we're on 4, special work of the Melchizedek. And then we go on to the Barondedex. So, Chuck, do you want to read that? You haven't read one in a long time.
Sure.
Go ahead, Chuck.
You can read this. Yeah, hey, thanks. Let's see. Section 4, special work of the Melchizedek's. Seems like everything they do is pretty special. Let's read about this. They say that a highly specialized branch of Melchizedek activities has to do with the supervision of the progressive Maronic career of the ascending mortals. Well, it's getting close to home. Much of this training is conducted by the patient and wise seraphic ministers, assisted by mortals who have ascended to relatively higher levels of universe attainment. But all of this educational work is under the general supervision of the Melchizedek's in association with the Trinity Teacher Sons. I got a lot of highly qualified people beings helping us out at every level.
They're like the school administrators.
Kind of.
I said they're like the school administrators, yeah.
Yeah. But they probably also lend a certain spirit to it, I imagine.
Right.
Anyway, while the Melchizedek orders are chiefly devoted to the vast educational system and experiential training regime of the local universe, they also function in unique assignments and in unusual circumstances. In an evolving universe, eventually embracing approximately 10 million inhabited worlds, many things out of the ordinary are destined to happen. And it is in such emergencies that the Melchizedek's act. On Edentia, your constellation headquarters, they're known as emergency sons. They're always ready to serve in all exigencies, physical, intellectual, or spiritual, whether on a planet, in a system, in a constellation, or in the universe. Whenever and wherever special help is needed, there you will find one or more of the Melchizedek sons. When failure of some feature of the Creator Son's plan is threatened, forthwith will go to Melchizedek to render assistance. But not often are they summoned to function in the presence of sinful rebellion, such as occurred in Satania. I guess because fortunately it doesn't happen that often. The Melchizedek's are the first to act in all emergencies of whatever nature on all worlds where will creatures dwell? Wow. Let me read that again. The Melchizedeks are the first to act in all emergencies of whatever nature on all worlds where will creatures dwell. They sometimes act as temporary custodians on wayward planets, serving as receivers of a defaulting planetary government. In a planetary crisis, these Melchizedek sons serve in many unique capacities. It is equally possible for such a son to make himself visible to mortal beings. And sometimes one of this order has even incarnated in the likeness of mortal flesh. Seven times in Nebadon has a Melchizedek served an evolutionary world in the similitude of mortal flesh. Mm. And on numerous occasions, these sons have appeared in the likeness of other orders of universe creatures. That's interesting.
Wow.
They are indeed the versatile and volunteer emergency ministers to all orders of universe intelligences and to all the worlds and systems of worlds. And that's all, that's pretty inclusive language there. The Melchizedek who lived on Urantia during the time of Abraham was locally known as Prince of Salem because he presided over a small colony of truth seekers residing at a place called Salem. He volunteered to incarnate in the likeness of mortal flesh and did so with the approval of the Melchizedek receivers of the planet, who feared that the light of life would become extinguished during that period of an increasing spiritual darkness. And he did foster the truth of his day and safely pass it on to Abraham and his associates.
Mm.
Indeed.
Wow,
and,
that's a great thing.
Of course, he thought a lot more than that, too. Or a lot in relation to that, maybe. You know, thinking about
a couple of things jumped out.
And all of that.
A couple of things jumped out for me. One is that it's only seven times in our local universe history, right? So that's 10
right.
million worlds,
yeah.
only seven times, eventually 10 million worlds. Only seven times so far has that happened as of the time of the writing. That's pretty interesting. And one of them, you know, not only the incarnation of our Creator Son, but the incarnation of a Melchizedek, one of seven and eventually 10 million. That's really, those are interesting numbers. The other thing that I wondered what is when they said he presided, meaning Machaventa, he presided over a small colony of truth seekers. Does anyone, maybe Andre, you remember how many were there at Salem when they say a small? I'm just curious as to how small.
You know, I don't have that handy, but I'll have a look.
Yeah.
It got up to a pretty good number, I think.
Yeah, it kept growing. I mean, he sent loads of people, you know, all over the earth. So trained up quite a group of people.
But it started with essentially a clan, right? It was a clan. It was Abraham's clan, essentially, don't you think? That
well,
he started with?
Melchizedek started the school before Abraham joined it. It took a while for Abraham to come around and become part of it. But when he did, he was a very strong. He became a strong leader of the colony. He organized the missionaries and did a whole lot that was helpful. But it took him
a while.
He
was a star student.
He wasn't there from
the
beginning.
Oh, okay. That's right.
Yeah, it's just interesting they used the qualifier small. I was just curious, you know, wonder what they meant by that, if there's any number. Yeah.
Well, what struck me is they are in general first responders. I typed that on the board. They're first responders. We all love first responders. And I can't, you know, that. I mean, that is so courageous. They're first responders. They jump in. They rush to where they are needed.
Yep.
They
yep.
don't hesitate. And
yeah.
it's a hero. They're the heroes of the universe. And oftentimes, the eldest brother in a family plays that role. Oftentimes.
Which is what they are.
You know?
Which is what they are.
Yeah,
they're
it's interesting.
Go ahead, Tom. they're the first created descending suns in a local universe. So there's four different orders. There's the Melchizedek's, the Verondedek's, the Lenonedek's, and the Life Carriers. Those are the four orders of descending suns, at least the Urantia book lists. But they're the first created. So they are the elder brothers.
They are. They're the elder brothers.
Which is what's so cool about them. I mean, to think about them in those terms. Yeah.
When you look at the role of the elder son.
That's the other thing. They outrank Lenonedek.
Right.
So what were you going to say, Paula?
Well, no, it's just the role of the eldest son is so often mimics this in a family.
Yeah.
You know, there's more expected of the eldest son. There's more, responsibility given to the eldest son. The eldest son is the most respected oftentimes within the family. I remembered as you were reading, Chuck, I remembered when I was a kid, some guy was threatening me. And I told him, I'm going to tell my brother Dick. And he jumped away from me. It's funny because I didn't tell him I'm going to tell my brother Mike, who was the brother closest to me, you know. I told him I'm going to tell my brother Dick, who was my eldest brother.
Mm.
And the guy jumped back. It's just interesting. I invoked the power of the eldest brother, you know.
All right.
Don't mess with me. I will tell my big brother. You know, and I named him.
Exactly.
And that was enough to make the guy leave me alone.
That's
so, it was isn't it funny where your mind goes when you're reading or somebody listening?
Leave me alone. I'm going to go get my older brother. Your
I'm
going to
go get my brother. I'm getting Machaventa here right now.
Yeah, right. No straightening out.
You will not bother me. And then we can bring out the big guns. I'm telling Jesus. And I'm invoking the power of Christ, you know. And interesting how that has happened on this world many times. You know, many times. People invoke the power of that name because it is powerful. You know, so, yeah, it's just interesting what they do and who they are. Jacob, Brother Dave says, Jacob, the stonemason's son. Yeah, exactly.
And
he obviously
thing,
had a lot of respect in the schoolyard, and nobody messed with him. Yeah.
Mm. It's also interesting that they say, you know, we're used to thinking of Melchizedek coming in a rebellion situation, but they say that rebellion is really only one and relatively rare of the sets of circumstances, well, Melchizedek will come in to deal with unexpected developments, emergency developments, and so the large majority of those unusual exigencies are not really rebellion related, you know. So that's really fascinating. Whenever there's unexpected stuff, surprise stuff, difficult to deal with stuff, these guys are the specialists, you know. They
and it's
come
so
in
physical,
and,
intellectual, or spiritual.
Yeah,
those three things.
So versatile. I found a paragraph where they talk about the size of the Salem colony.
Okay.
Read that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's in paper 93, section 6, the last paragraph of that section, paragraph 8. And it's talking about Abraham. And they say, upon the consummation of the solemn covenant, the reconciliation between Abraham and Melchizedek was complete. So this is, you know, this thing that went down between the two of them. Abraham again assumed the civil and military leadership of the Salem colony, which at its height carried over 100,000 regular tithe payers on the rolls of the Melchizedek Brotherhood. And they go on to say that Abraham greatly improved the Salem temple and provided new tents for the entire school. He not only extended the tithing system, but also instituted many improved methods of conducting the business of the school, besides contributing greatly to the better handling of the Department of Missionary Propaganda. He also did much to effect improvement of the herds and the reorganization of the Salem dairying projects. Abraham was a shrewd and efficient businessman, a wealthy man for his day, He was not overly pious, but he was thoroughly sincere. And he did believe in Machiavelli and Melchizedek. So anyway, 100,000 tithe payers, however we interpret that. But it gives a sense of the size of the colony. That's pretty substantial.
Yeah, that was a group of believers. And it would also be interesting that, you know, when they talk about the school at Salem and the missionaries, again, those are, I'm sure, smaller subsets. It's just interesting. I mean, what numbers of devoted teachers would they have trained that would have then gone out? And, of course, they went out over subsequent generations. I mean, I think they established a whole lineage of the Salem teachers that went out generation after generation. Their progeny went out and then they were dispersed. But I'm just curious.
There's that group
of
late bands.
The 90 odd years that Melchizedek was teaching in here. It'd be interesting to have a sense of how many teachers he actually trained in that initial core of
mm-hmm.
not just followers, but people who were the teacher leaders of that movement. I got the sense that Abraham wasn't really involved in that so much. He doesn't sound like either an academic or a missionary type. They say he
wasn't
very involved. He was an administrator and a warrior, you know.
But what they said about him, he did mm-hmm. much to affect, you know, what did they say? He contributed greatly to the better handling of the missionary propaganda. He brought his military strategy into the efforts of the missionaries. And, I mean, not in a fighting sense, but in terms of an organizational sense, like you're saying. But he contributed greatly to the better handling of the missionary project. So that sounds.
Yeah, but that's still the impression I have is that he was primarily an administrator. He wasn't really a spiritual teacher. He was the sense I have was he was a very, very effective organizer and administrator. He had the purse strings and he had the political power. So I think he was seminal. He just doesn't strike me as someone who is a spiritual. He doesn't strike.
Too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
but he doesn't
probably true too.
Yeah, it doesn't strike me as someone who has a sort of any deeper discerning spiritual acumen.
Well,
he wasn't really
yeah,
a spiritual
yeah, no,
teacher. Yeah.
He's not like a Moses or something. Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
more of a
yeah.
David Zebedee.
That's what I
you know?
Yeah. That's what I would think.
Yeah.
You know, or an organizer.
But with an organizer. But with an edge, you know, of leadership.
But with an edge.
He was inspiring. he was inspiring these missionaries. He was passing through the inspiration from Melchizedek. In other words, he had a spirit of enthusiasm and leadership, and all of those assets, I think, were playing through this. Otherwise, that missionary program wouldn't have been nearly so successful, I don't think.
And he obviously loved Melchizedek.
It wasn't just a desk job.
He
got his answer, I'm sure.
Maybe he was inspiring. Yeah, true. It's interesting.
He wasn't
it's hard
a
to know.
Genius necessarily, but he had other kind of genius.
Right. You know, I have to point out a great example of Melchizedek stepping in with a physical issue. And this came to mind in just shifting gears a little bit, but away from Abraham. But you know, and that's I love. It's interesting. We're all studying Melchizedek right now because we're getting ready for this conference coming up. So obviously, you guys on the board and listeners, you can tell we're very interested in Melchizedek because we're going to this conference in a few weeks. That's going to be all about the Melchizedeks and particularly Machiavelli Melchizedek. It's the Fellowship Summer Study Session in Illinois, and it's coming right up. But here's an instance where the Melchizedeks step in a physical catastrophe. This is from paper 51, and I'm not going to read the whole paragraph, just the middle of it. It's 51.2.3. If some physical catastrophe should doom the planetary residents of an evolving race, the Melchizedeks and the life carriers would install the technique of dematerialization for all survivors. And by seraphic transport, these beings would be carried away to the new world prepared for their continuing existence. The evolution of a human race, once initiated on a world of space, must proceed quite independently of the physical survival of that planet. So there's a great example of the, you know, you can just imagine them springing into action, the first responders of the universe, right? And with the life carriers installing this dematerialization technique for all the survivors. And, you know, how instrumental they are in that process. It's hard to picture, yeah. But it's interesting. They do give us a very specific place where they intervene in a physical emergency. And intellectual would be a harder one to, yeah, Super Caledocious on the board says, the rapture. what the rapture foreshadows. But, yeah,
well, you know,
intellectual would be an interesting one. What kind of an intellectual emergency would we have, you know, that they'd have to jump in?
You know, here's a...
Well, it's a physical emergency.
Here's another interesting thing to think about related to Melchizedek's and their functions and their history of function on our world in particular. with the summer study session, we're going to be looking at Melchizedek, and I'm doing this workshop where this sort of looks at, it's an idea that David Kielicki came forward with originally, which really struck me, and I've spent a lot of time just mulling it over because I thought, oh, that's really an interesting assertion or possibility, and that was the idea that the Melchizedek mission, Jesus' bestowal, and the Urantia Revelation were really conceptualized and planned as a triune revelatory impact in a very coordinated fashion and very much strategically planned as a threefold stimulus to the history and trajectory of our world. And I rather suspect that the Melchizedek is in order because that is such an unusual undertaking. Everything around Michael's bestowal would be unusual. But the idea that 2,000 years before and 2,000 years after, you have these two additional revelations that bracket his bestowal, I think is hardly coincidental. I think it's got to be. They had to have been thinking. That's such a small time frame for them. But it's such a critical juncture in the evolution of civilization. I mean, we moved from... barely out of tribal clans. We had the earliest formation of city-states back 4,000 years ago, but hardly even there, all the way to where we are now with a global 24/7 technological culture. In 4,000 years, they had to have been able to foresee that we were coming up to this incredibly stressful and complex juncture, and here was Jesus bestowal right in the middle of that and stimulating development. And the Urantia Revelation is so, in many ways, so meant to consolidate Jesus bestowal and the Melchizedek incarnation and really ramp it out with the implications that flow from Jesus bestowal that he could never really share with the culture of his day.
Right.
I mean, just as one example, he talked about in my father's universe, there are many mansions, and they had such a simplistic understanding of what that could mean, right? He couldn't tell them because they had no cosmology, they had no astronomy that could put it together. And here we have now this revelation where two-thirds of it arguably is about what's going on out in the universe and the structure and the nature of the universe. So that's got to have been a consolidation and building upon what Jesus was initially foreshadowing, right? But I'm sorry, it's a long way of getting around to saying I think the whole threefold enterprise was run by and administered by the Melchizedeks. Obviously, much more went into Jesus' bestowal, but I think I just took a look, and 29 out of the 196 papers in the Urantia Revelation are authored by Melchizedek. There may be another mighty messengers. Many of them are mighty messengers, but I'm not sure there. And the entirety, that's short of part four. The entirety of part four, the midwayers wrote it, but it was supervised by the Melchizedek receivers. So they had overall jurisdiction of even part four, and that's in addition to the 29 other papers in the first three parts. So obviously, this revelation is the work of the Melchizedeks with under their supervision, many orders working collaboratively with them. So that's really interesting to think about their role in this revelation and in the three of them, really, setting the stage, Jesus bestowal, and then ramping out the effect of Jesus bestowal with this fifth epical revelation.
So let me ask you this, guys. One thing that's always intrigued me is when they reported that the light of truth, they felt like the light of truth was near going extinct on Urantia, and they needed to do something, and the universe said back to them, who was it? Who was it that gave them this, you know, advice or to tell them, you know, no, go ahead and handle it. Do whatever you think is best. That wasn't so much being laissez-faire, you know, like, oh, well, you guys can handle it. Go do it, you know, like a boss saying to an employee, go do it. It was more confidence, I think, in them and their ability to handle the situation to say, no, you do it. We have faith in you. Go do it. We know you'll do the right thing.
You're on the ground and you're best qualified to make that judgment. Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's the way I always take it, that the universe was just expressing tremendous confidence in them to do the right thing. We know you'll do the right thing. You've got a handle on it. What do you think is right? Yeah. Do it. Yeah.
Well, they first petitioned the Most Highs of Evidentia, and then that plea was dismissed.
Right, the Most High.
The mandate that, this is 93.1.2, with the mandate that, quote, the conduct of affairs on 606 of Spetania is fully in the hands of the Melchizedek custodians. The receivers then appealed to the Father Melchizedek for help, but only received word that they should continue to uphold truth in the manner of their own election, quote, until the arrival of a bestowal son who, quote, would rescue the planetary titles from forfeiture and uncertainty. That's an interesting way of putting that.
If
you think about it, you know, what better order of beings in our local universe? If they were going to set out to say, okay, Jesus has been here on this world is so confused and so impoverished in its understanding of what's going on here, these unfortunate races of human beings, and we need to provide a major body of revelation that begins to catch them up and inform them as to who they are and what's going on in the cosmos and amplifies the life and teachings of the bestowal son and presents it as they really were, who better as a group of beings to mastermind and craft that huge mission of this Urantia revelation than the Melchizedeks as an order of being, you know, and that apparently is how they've served as the receivers, you know, overseeing this revelation. And so I don't think it's just Melchizedek originally. I think they're playing a current, very, very active current role with this revelation that we have.
Mm-hmm. And the 12 receivers arrived at the time of the rebellion. So that was 200,000 years ago.
And that was clearly the emergency that called them
included
in, right?
Machiavenna, from what I can tell. The there was an earlier group of Melchizedeks who came with the life carriers at the time of life implantation, and that was a different group. They make that clear. But at the time of the rebellion, that's when the 12 Melchizedek receivers arrived, and they were, you know, pretty much keeping an eye on things all the way through, and except for a brief period during Adam and Eve's life, they departed. After about 7 years, I think they say, once the garden was up and running and Adam and Eve were there and everything was going along, they took off, just went back to Jerusalem. And as soon as the fall happened, they were right back again. So that was a brief hiatus of their presence on the planet. But apart from that, I think they've been here solid since the time of the rebellion. I mean, well,
yeah.
I don't, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, now
yeah,
there's the Seraphic Planetary Government, which kind of took their place. But Machiavenna is clearly still very involved. And he's on the Council of 24 and all of that.
Right,
he's been a resident
right.
Governor General.
And Vice Garant's Planetary Prince.
And he's going to be our Planetary Prince someday. We're all looking forward to that.
Right. Right.
But, and there aren't, yeah. there aren't very many authors of the paper that they actually name by name. You know, most
That's
of them are identified by one of a like a perfecter of wisdom, a universal censor, et cetera, et cetera. But there are several papers that are authored by particular Melchizedeks that they name. I mean, there's also Solonia. I think Solonia is named as an author. But you've got Mandelvet. I might be misremembering, but Mantusha. Manavanda.
Malabasia.
Yeah, so there are several names individuals. So I wouldn't be surprised if those are actually members of that group of the 12 core of the receivers, the Melchizedek receivers.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
So
that's
really interesting.
Probably why they name them, yeah. Mantusha.
Yeah, they tend to name
like
beings
four out of the 12.
That play loom large in our interest and loom large in our career, in our ascending career.
And maybe those are the ones we're most likely to meet. Or maybe we'll be most likely first, at least. That's why they've given us their names. So like,
they tell us about Lanaford. He's
Mandibet.
One of our
well,
system
right.
fathers. Oh, I know you.
Yeah, I remember reading.
Yeah.
That was a nice
you
paper.
Wrote that
I remember reading about you. We'll be pretty starstruck, won't we?
Starstruck
when we meet Amadon. Yeah, that's true.
I was looking at the table of contents. Yeah, Mandavet, the one who wrote the Lucifer Value paper. So that's a major assignment in terms of the Rancher book as a book. That particular paper. So.
Oh boy, talk about tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they named that's it. Melchizedek who wrote it. It's great.
Yeah. Well, they so loom large in our world history, and you know, here they are, you know, watching over us through this most difficult time, and it's a long time. They've been in charge of the world.
Yeah.
A lot of.
Well, who knows what kind of plans they're cooking up too.
Right. Wouldn't we like to know? But maybe this book has a lot of their plans in it. I think that's true.
But maybe between the lines, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, between the lines, right. Because what they think is important for us to know is what's getting into this revelation, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the structure of this paper, they're finished now with the Melchizedeks, and they move on to the Ruan Index and then the Lenon Index, And what's interesting is the Melchizedeks function all throughout the local universe from the super universe headquarters, and they're dispatched on these emergency missions. So they're functioning at all levels. They primarily run the Melchizedek University, but they're engaged in these emergency missions all the way down to the planets. And we've been fortunate to have so much exposure to their work and their teaching. I wouldn't be surprised if there are relatively few other planets that have benefited from their ministry as much as ours has. But next they go on to talk about the Verondadex, who function primarily at the constellation level. So it's interesting that these suns are sort of specialized at certain levels of administration. That's kind of intriguing to think about.
Yeah, and it all seems to have something to do with education, you know, on some level. That's kind of their thing.
Right.
But they take it on in these,
Education
which is sometimes an emergency intervention. Yeah.
Yeah, also administration, though. Like the Verondadex and Lenondadex are many of them administrators, as are the Melchizedeks in some ways. But you're right, I think the Melchizedeks are primarily teaching orders.
That's what they seem to suggest, right. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But they also function in this emergency capacity, but that's typically a teaching thing in itself, like
right.
it was here.
Right.
But then when you think of McAvenis stepping in to his role as planetary prince, I mean, as vicegerent, I don't know, when once he steps into that role, if we still call him vicegerent, or is he, well, I guess Michael's there. That holds the title of planetary prince. But McAvenis, sometime, maybe any day or any hour, they say, will be our new planetary prince in a very real sense.
He'll be installed. Yeah.
Installed.
I wonder
yeah.
how many times that's happened in the history of this universe.
Where you have a Melchizedek becoming a planetary prince.
Yeah.
That's
oh,
very
right.
seems like that must be very unusual.
It seems
yeah,
like that.
No, that's never. That's he's
yeah.
vicegerent of Michael. How often does Michael declare a vicegerent on a world,
uh-huh.
and for what reason? There's a special reason
yeah.
here. He's planetary
yeah.
prince.
Absolutely.
He's
yeah.
not planetary right. prince anywhere else, as far as we know.
Right. Right.
So vicegerent means the administrative
too.
Deputy of a king or a magistrate. So
mm-hmm.
yeah.
McAvenis is like the king's hand here.
Yeah,
he's the
yeah.
king's hand. Yeah.
He would act
and he refuses
Michael.
To do anything just yet.
Right.
Yeah, that's
other than to be,
too.
You know, a normal member of the Council of 24 and go through the rotation being the Governor General, which he's done once already, about 900 to 1,000 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So I guess when Michael took over as planetary prince, when he seized that title from Caligastes, that would be an example of rescuing the planetary titles from forfeiture
mm-hmm.
and uncertainty.
There you go. Yes. The titles being the titles of the prince, the titles of...
Yeah, but there may be other titles
yeah.
mixed in there too. But
yeah.
the title planetary prince is one that we're also concerned about.
Right.
Well, and it's more than
and
you
Michael
know,
did rescue
title.
That planetary title from forfeiture and uncertainty. So
that's true, and Caligastus certainly besmirched it, right? I mean, he's known
yeah.
as the Prince of Darkness. That's one of his monikers, the Prince of Darkness. So it's not like
sure.
us humans don't know who he is. You know, that always struck me about the Urantia book. It builds on what we already know. We have a vague sense about these things, but it builds on them. For us and lets us
mm-hmm.
know, no, this is, you know, yeah, you did have a prince. He fell into darkness. He is the Prince of Darkness, you know, and you know him as such.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not your imagination. It's real.
Mm-hmm.
And I
yeah,
think,
so
you know,
go ahead, Paula.
No, go ahead, Marvin. I was done.
Well, there's the title. There's also the vacuum of the role and the function. You know, I mean, we had
right.
a planetary prince, Caligastia, and he's no longer filling that role. He may still be around. He may not. He may have been interned since the time of this revelation. But there's a huge...
I don't think so.
there's a huge vacuum in terms of function in that role.
So that's a good point about the
McAvenis is filling. Yeah.
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 Well, and the resident sure. governor general and the
yeah, resident governor general
are all
the,
of that. Mm-hmm.
The respective fathers of the planet, right?
Pretty
Which
much,
is an
yeah.
interesting way to refer to them. They are regarded as they're looked up to by all celestial beings serving on the planet while they're here. Former human beings or former
right.
defaulted material sons. Or McAventa, or 1, 2, 3, the first. You know,
they all have the planet in common, though.
They all have the planet in common. They all served here in one way or another in material or semi-material form. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Andre,
yeah,
can you
we're
expound
not without
on
leadership.
What...
We've got leadership.
Well, that's true.
And unfortunately, maybe it will change our minds on the next world. I'm saying it'd be nice to know that Caligastia was gone and Daligastia. I think those are the only two that are left here of everybody
yeah,
else. Everybody
good.
Else is chained. So
But eventually, we'll be done with that.
Eventually, yeah.
God knows when.
you mentioned that Machaventa isn't doing anything. I didn't mean it that way.
He's doing a lot.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's
he's
why.
On the council
I mean, would you clarify what? Yeah. And
yeah.
does he defer to the resident governor general? That person, that being right now, is the de facto head of the planet, and Machaventa is, you know, overseeing.
Yes, they indicate
not...
he's made no effort to upset that rotation. You know, he's
right.
done his own rotation of 100 years, a little less than 100 years ago, they said, in 1934. And so you can assume that that was 900 to 1,000 years ago now, and, you know, roughly. And only that, saying that he would be due to return in a little more than 1,000 years, which would roughly put, you know, that rotation, if there's a rotation of every 2,300 years you're back, that would roughly be it. You know, you leave and you're back in 2,300 years. So we can expect him to be back here in, you know, another 11, 12, 1,300 years, approximately.
Importantly, it's going to change out in a very short while. In 8 years or so, it's going to change out again.
Well,
yeah.
Anyway, my
we will have our
21st. Assumption, the working mm-hmm. assumption for me is that the vice chair and planetary prince and the resident governor general are two functional roles with probably different administrative responsibilities and functions. So I don't get, you know, Audrey. Yeah, I imagine that the planetary prince, Machaventa, is active and he's engaged. He's just engaged in other functions than the resident governor mm-hmm. general, and they don't work at cross purposes. They work complementarily. Yeah, yeah. So, but I bet you he's busy with that role as well.
To what degree,
you know,
do you think Michael is directly
yeah.
involved?
Yeah. I think
Michael,
you know,
that's the
Michael
very
is,
interesting thing. You know, he's like Michael in that respect. He doesn't,
you
know, what did Michael do, you know, at Pentecost? That's what's really interesting to consider. Michael instituted a regime where former human beings would be placed in administrative authority for, you know, legislative, executive, you know, and, you know, low-level judicial functions, but especially for the administration of certain aspects of mercy when it's, you know, the Council of 24 weighs in on the advisability of certain individuals resurrecting. And if that's the case, it's not to say, no, this they shouldn't, as much as a questionable one, no, resurrect this person. It's part of the mercy function.
Mm.
That's pretty astounding. And how did it happen?
Yeah.
It happened because Michael, now as supreme sovereign in Nebadon, became such by having an experience as a human being and understanding the human condition fully, knowing it inside and out, and honoring that and understanding the value of what it means for people to achieve, you know, an understanding, an evolutionary understanding of what to do, especially if they grow spiritually throughout it. And all 24 have done that, including the 8 temporary members. We always forget the 8 unnamed temporary members. But if we've had 20 so far, we've had a certain number of those temporary members have already served.
There's so much brilliance
they're,
in that plan,
equal.
Too, when you think about it.
Yeah.
Every 100 years, that's 5 generations. For 5 generations, you get to go down there and enact something you really believe the planet needs. It's the way I look at it, you know. You get to oversee a certain amount of the evolution and even guide and direct some of it. to something you feel very passionate about. You know?
Yeah. There's another there's another being in the picture I think is also very important and no doubt has a lot of influence, which is Lanaforge. And they comment here in paper 45.2.4, they say that while all the affairs of the isolated worlds of Satania have not been returned to his jurisdiction, Lanaforge discloses great interest in their welfare, and he is a frequent visitor on Urantia. As other normal systems, he presides over the system councils, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, that idea that he's a frequent visitor here, I like that. That makes me feel good. He actually comes here.
He's the most trustworthy system sovereign in the universe.
I know.
Rebellion tested.
He's got a great story.
He's rebellion tested. Yeah.
Yep, right. Absolutely.
Lanaforge. Yay.
Yeah. So
one of our seven fathers.
Even though we can't see him, he's here frequently. That's a good positive influence on this world, I think. That fact that he does that, takes that on personally, you know, almost. Given that fictional issues have not been completely worked out, in spite of that, he's taking a personal interest to the point of actually coming here frequently just to see how things are going. So. But he no doubt meets with
very
the delegate administrator. You know, whoever the resident governor general at the time, you know, he's involved with all of that in some, even if not formal way, it's important way, just as a moral support maybe, or who knows.
Right.
Encouraging the administration of this planet to keep up the fight, you know.
Oh, they have their hands full.
Yeah, it's a tough planet. It's a tough planet.
It's a tough neighborhood.
It is. It is indeed. I don't know if it's that much tougher than the others, 37, but it's right in there.
I like to think, the way I think of it is, you know, and we all love to, the interregnum quote seems to be one of the most popular quotes recently, and it's always interesting to me how certain things go through our movement, like, you know, and we all seem to be thinking about those things, and then they bubble up here or there in a study or a theme, or, you know, and you hear a lot of people quoting that, and but that the dangerous velocities always intrigues me, and the break or the inertia that has to happen to pull us back. And I think that a more primitive planet in its innocence, I guess, is easier in some ways to manage than a planet that's like ours, where you have technology that's really in the hands of somebody who thinks primitively. Devastating. The double-edged sword aspect of our technology is so scary when you think that there are people on the planet who would use it for such ill purposes and evil purposes.
I think one of the implications that flows from our being a rebellion sphere, which means there are vacuums of leadership that a planet would normally have, spiritual leadership, in particular the planetary prince and the Adam and Eve, who would be lead persistent administrations in interaction with the human administrations of the planet that would provide order and balance and integration between material and spiritual priorities and the whole, because that whole interregnum passage talks about worship wisdom and the lack of spiritual wisdom, really.
Right.
Integrated with the material and technological progress, and that's what makes it so dangerous. When material advances outrun the development of worship wisdom, as they describe it. In other words, we're way more technologically developed than we are spiritually sophisticated in terms of how to manage those powerful tools that we've developed. And they describe that as a very, very dangerous situation. And I think the reason, you're right, Paul, the reason we come back, we circle back to that theme often is because those of us who are familiar with this revelation, and we're living in this culture, right, this crazy quilt Urantian culture at this moment in history and cultural and civilizational development, we feel the chaos of it. We feel the danger of it, of these powerful forces that could destroy us and our environment, you know, environmentally and technologically and militarily and economically. We sense these threatening factors that are technologically driven, just about all of them. And when we sense the lack of spiritual maturity in much of our leadership to use those powerful tools, and it, so it feels like a car that's barreling down the freeway at 90 miles an hour, and the people steering and braking and accelerating are really half drunk. You know, they're just they're not really guided by any real discernment, and their ability to discern what's wise is dramatically blunted by their lack of spiritual depth, you know. And so that feels like a dangerous situation.
And it is a dangerous situation, clearly.
Yeah. And I think,
you know,
this
unless they're driving
is
a Tesla
being...
Model 3, you know.
yeah,
that's
well,
an inside joke, friends.
We won't go there. How much discernment and wisdom there is on the part of Model 3 drivers, but you know, I mean, it's a bizarre situation we're in, and here we have this revelation.
It is bizarre.
And you know, the hope is that this revelation will spread far enough and wide enough and begin to inform our leadership sufficiently to be a stabilizing factor over the next several generations. I think that's part of the hope and mission of this revelation.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to look at how, just in our short time with this revelation, with this book, how much technology has influenced our study of it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
our formation of communities. In our formation of communities.
Right.
But this, you know, I especially think about the study, you know, having a search engine technology was not even mind's eye. It was not even in the mind's eye of the human race in the 1920s, you know, the idea of having a search engine where you could digitize text and search it and research it.
Mm.
You know, the book was created at a time when that didn't exist. Look how important it is to our study to be able
to open
multiple search windows and do correlations and, you know, associate.
Yeah.
Language from one part of the book with another part of the book and see how they fit together and create this more dimensional, three-dimensional, four-dimensional, who knows how many dimensional kind of framing and mind space with which we now engage with the book. And that was all potential when it was printed in the 50s, but nobody even would guess that that would be showing up so quickly in our experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, I've probably told this story before, but, you know, here at the house, we've got a lot of John Hayes, you know, old library stuff. And included in that are these huge volumes from back in the day, you know, the early days of Sadler and them, where when they wanted to do a study, they had to go in with a typewriter and type all the different search results of paragraphs that were relevant to a topic, right? And you could just tell this was all done by hand with note cards and bookmarks and endless hours of physical typing to create these tomes. Some of them are quite substantial, these topical reference works of just pulling quotes.
Clyde Bedell's
Concordance. Just like we do now.
Yeah.
Just like we do now.
Yeah.
Except back then it was all done, you know, manually with great labor. So,
and trying to remember where a quote was on a page.
Oh, my God,
or in the book. Yeah, almost. Uh-huh. I mean, Clyde was the first one to come out with a study aid that actually helped us find a quote again out of a book with more than a million words. And here we are, you know, trying to find this one quote that was so relevant to what we're thinking.
We know
what
it's in there somewhere.
You know, we know it's in there somewhere. And we remember where it was on the page. We remember about where it showed up.
What page was it?
And he really helped. It was so valuable what he did.
That was a big step.
Yeah. And
but
then to go from that.
What a concept.
Yeah. And we owe that to our sister Krista Mahara, who painstakingly over a period of a year, over a period of an entire year, she took apart a first edition Urantia book, took it apart, and page by page by page, scanned it in to a surgeon. Yes.
Using OCR software, optical character recognition software, which was in its infancy at that time.
What a labor of love. And she corrected errors that, you know, I mean, that happened as a result of the poor technology and whatever. I mean, it was just the most extraordinary labor of love, and it's one of the things I'm most thankful for. But mentioning technology and what it does for us, Chuck, you got to think of the Internet. Oh, my goodness.
Well, yeah.
We've been able to spread these teachings all over the world because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Without having to schlep books to wherever, you know, in our suitcases, which we do that too, but we don't have to do that now to spread this these teachings, and they had to have seen it.
Yeah.
I'm
well,
so grateful for
the celestial overseers of this project. Now, in the 50s, when it was being printed on paper, they could foresee these things, but they didn't have any way to tell us about it because it was beyond our concept, even, you know, have any idea. You know, the Internet and World Wide Web and all that stuff. They busted it. I don't know. They must have, just said, okay, we can't tell them about this because it's going to happen, but they don't know about it. And it's always like that, I'm sure. So who knows, sitting here today, what might be coming up in the near future that we don't have no idea about. They could be good, in other words, not just all the disasters that might happen that we're also well aware or constantly kind of worrying about. But what about the good things that are going to happen? You know, there may be some remarkable transformation of something we haven't even thought about that's going to open up a whole new realm of possibility, you know, kind of like a search engine did.
Oh, without a doubt. They're already expecting
There's a whole virtual universe that Gabriel Reinberg and his team is working on in Israel that is the Jesus Metaverse. And, you know, that's in the works. It's still probably a little ways off, but that will be
something where
people can actually look things up and correlate literal times in Jesus' life from the Urantia book with being able to see and immerse oneself in vignettes of what was happening, you know, at that time. You know, it's going to be a brand new experience. But I want to just say, you know, we're meandering quite a bit here from our paper. I'm wondering, why don't we just read the next section? We're not going to be meeting on this next week because two of us are absent. And so whatever we do next week, whether we're meeting or not, we won't be doing this. So why don't we read the next section?
I think it might be good.
I'm down for that.
Just before we do that, there was, going back to the section we did read. There was one There was one point in there that we haven't talked about that I just pretty startling, and I don't want to drag us into a long thing about it, but where they say that, speaking of the Melchizedek, this is in paragraph 4, that they, such a son, is, they can make themselves visible to mortal beings.
Right.
So Melchizedek served many unique capacities. It is easily possible for such a son to make himself visible to mortal beings. I mean, that's a startling statement, because of all the celestial beings that we read about, think about all the time, they're the only ones that they really say that about. I mean, we know secondary midwares can do that. Probably the Marashi Cherubim can do that, and maybe angels too. Who knows? But for Melchizedek to do that would be pretty – I mean, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about that, but – it occurs to me that if he does take over as planetary prince at some point, which he's no doubt going to do, he could do that. He could make himself visible. He would be finally, at last, we would have a visible representation of higher universe, you know, administration on the planet. Even if he was, even if he wasn't visible all the time, maybe just some of the time, or whatever. But
well, which
it would
that
make
is
it a
intriguing
lot harder to apprehend such a being from the human level, right? You know, like they with Jesus, you know, they were easily able to do their worst. But with a Melchizedek, that wouldn't be possible in the same way. He's like, here I am, now I'm gone, good luck. I don't mean to make light of it, but it feels significant. It feels significant in terms of actually stepping into a serious role on this planet, given the way things are.
Well, they reflect. Authors must be reflecting on that, because when a Melchizedek speaks about that in paper 93 near the end, you know, we well understand how by his triumph on Urantia, Michael became the, by the way, I'm on 93.10.7, Michael became the successor of both Caligastia and Adam, how he became the planetary prince of peace and the second Adam. And now we behold the conferring upon this Melchizedek of the title vicegerent planetary prince of Urantia. Will he also be constituted vicegerent material son of Urantia? Is there a possibility of an unexpected and unprecedented event is to take place to sometime return to the planet of Adam and Eve, or certain of their progeny or representatives of Michael, and the titles vicegerents of the second Adam of Urantia? Now, the question that comes up for me with that is this. You know, why bring up the idea of vicegerent material son of Urantia unless there was some similitude? And what you're bringing up here, Chuck, and reminding us of is the fact that Melchizedeks can make themselves visible to material eyes.
Mm.
And that's unusual.
Mm-hmm.
That is quite unusual.
Mm-hmm. And they can even appear as a different order of universe creature.
Yeah.
And other types of, right, it could be other.
That intrigued me, yeah.
Yeah.
That could be pretty startling. Wow. Well,
so,
I'm glad you brought that up, Chuck, because that is important to remember. And
it's an intriguing detail, yeah.
Yeah, it's an intriguing detail. And we don't know how many times he's done it or does it, but I've had several readers tell me that they think that they've experienced that. So that's very
intriguing. Had encounters, even.
Yeah,
I know.
That they've had encounters with Melchizedek. Let's
not go there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember any specifics,
that somebody could have had that. It's a rabbit hole.
It is definitely a rabbit hole.
Could we read the next section?
Can we read section number five?
Sure. It's a short one. It's only three paragraphs. So go ahead, Marvin.
No,
you want to read it?
Six paragraphs.
Yeah.
Oh, is it? It's six. Sorry. I'm looking at the...
Yeah. And we can always reread it when we get together next, you know, to refresh our memories. But just to put it in the thought streams. Yeah. The Verondadex sons. After the creation of the personal aids and the first group of the versatile Melchizedeks, the creator son and the local universe creative spirit planned for and brought into existence the second great and diverse order of universe sonship, the Verondadeks. They are more generally known as constellation fathers, because a son of this order is uniformly found at the head of each constellation government in every local universe. The number of Verondadeks varies in each local universe, just 1 million being the recorded number in Nebadon. These sons, like their coordinates, the Melchizedeks, possess no power of reproduction. There exists no known method whereby they can increase their numbers.
What caught me was that the father Melchizedek is involved in reproduction of the Melchizedek order, but it sounds like generally both the Melchizedeks and the Bononadeks don't self-reproduce. They don't couple and reproduce. In many respects, these sons are a self-governing body. As individuals and as groups, even as a whole, they are largely self-determinative, much as are the Melchizedeks. But Vorondadeks do not function through such a wide range of activities. They do not equal their Melchizedek brethren in brilliant versatility, but they are even more reliable and efficient as rulers and far-seeing administrators. Neither are they quite the administrative peers of their subordinates, the Lemongendek system sovereigns, but they excel all orders of universe sonship in stability of purpose and in divinity of judgment. Those are interesting qualities, stability of purpose and divinity of judgment. Although the decisions and rulings of this order of sons are always in accordance with a spirit of divine sonship and in harmony with the policies of the Creator Son, they have been cited for error to the Creator Son. And in details of technique, their decisions have sometimes been reversed on appeal to the superior tribunals of the universe. But these sons rarely fall into error, and they have never gone into rebellion. Never in all the history of Nevadon has a Vorondadek been found in contempt of the universe government. That's significant. The service of the Vorondadeks in the local universes is extensive and varied. They serve as ambassadors to other universes, and as consuls representing constellations within their native universe. Of all the orders of local universe sonship, they are the most often entrusted with a full delegation of sovereign powers to be exercised in critical universe situations. On those worlds segregated in spiritual darkness, those spheres which have, through rebellion and default, suffered planetary isolation, an observer Vorondadek is usually present pending the restoration of normal status. In certain emergencies, this Most High Observer could exercise absolute and arbitrary authority over every celestial being assigned to that planet. It is of record on Salvington that the Vorondadeks have sometimes exercised such authority as Most High Regents of such planets. And this has also been true even of inhabited worlds that were untouched by rebellion. Often a core of 12 or more Vorondadek sons sits on Bunk as a high court of review and appeal concerning special cases involving the status of a planet or a system. I guess on Bonk means they function as a group. But their work more largely pertains to the legislative functions indigenous to the constellation governments. So sometimes they'll function on a planet or system, but mostly at constellation level. As a result of all these services, the Vorondadek sons have become the historians of the local universes. They are personally familiar with all the political struggles and the social upheavals of the inhabited worlds. That's interesting, that last statement.
Yeah, sure is.
They are the historians who focus on the political struggles and social upheavals of the inhabited worlds. Boy, I bet you they are a store of wisdom on stuff that we're dealing with.
It's good to know.
I bet they are.
They know this stuff goes on. I mean, it's just obviously it does, but it's comforting to know that they're cognizant of the fact that we do have political struggles and social upheavals. on the inhabited worlds.
Well, can you imagine, okay, if our constellation is on average as developed as the rest of the local universe, there would be approximately 38,400 planets in existence in the constellation. That's what they're aware of. They're aware of all that history on all those worlds. I mean, we were talking earlier today about not being able to imagine Marantia mind. Well, imagine their minds, you know, and what they hold in mind, knowing all of the history, some of those worlds being billions of years old. Not many, but some of them are billions of years old.
Right.
And they know all of that history.
highly evolved.
Francois and I have been watching a series on Apple TV, which is just wonderful. There's only one season, and I can't wait for the second one. But it's called Foundation, and it's Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy.
Yeah, I've been watching it,
too. Yeah, the one of the central characters, Harry Seldon, he's such an interesting character.
Yeah.
He comes along and he's almost like a demigod in some ways. He's such an interesting figure, but he's what they call a psychohistorian. We got a lot of background noises, so we might want to mute if we're not talking. Chuck, I think you might want to mute. But he's a psychohistorian, which is really interesting and very, very sophisticated. And what he's able to do, since he is familiar with the history, because these Vorontideks are the historians of the local universe, right? He's able to chart using the history and the premises and the precedents of literally thousands of worlds over all their ages. He's able to chart the present moment out into the future, and he projects a crisis in the universe management that will consume 30,000, that will unfold 30,000 years into the future. He's able to project that as a historian and make suggestions as to how to remedy the deterioration of the galactic empire on these thousands of worlds. He's able to make a projection and a set of suggestions as to how to preserve the legacy of galactic civilization in the interim of the, quote, dark ages that are coming. And so he's such a pivotal figure in terms of how to understand origin, history, and destiny as it unfolds historically. And it's just fascinating that his discipline is he's a historian, and he's in such a pivotal position. It's just
he's a mathematician as well.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
He's utilizing the mathematics, statistics, basically, you know, but sophisticated statistics and algorithms, and frankly, you know, they're projecting AI. This was Isaac Asimov who wrote the Foundation trilogy, and it was so prescient, you know, in terms of what we might be able to do to be able to describe the describe mass movements. And even if this is something that's virtually impossible for human beings to do with great accuracy, in the same way that it's difficult still for us to predict the weather, which is a similar kind of a task, it still is prescient in the sense that he tapped into something. You know, we're told about Marantia mathematics. You know, we're told about the fact that you can actually mathematically describe some kinds of things that are not dealing entirely with just physical kinds of things. You can deal with Marantia realities and describe them, such as two people working together, more nearly equal four, or 10 people pulling together, more nearly, you know, is the square of those people functioning together to pull together. You know, that's that's something that the Veranda decks can do. They're actually, they're not only historically aware, they're probably mathematically aware as well, and probably can project forward, as, you know, Marvin has so astutely, you know, brought to mind. It's just wonderful, you know, to think about this stuff and to imagine what we're actually a part of. There's nothing that is surprising too much to them. Maybe a Michael,
the importance of
maybe
history.
A Michael son coming and bestowing himself, maybe that's a surprise. But they forecast that all was not right in Lucifer's mind, you know, some 100 standard years or something before that happened, 500 of our years beforehand. So they're always watching what might be unfolding. They're not surprised by anything.
So I got to share this paragraph because it's so related to this idea of cycle history and projecting out into the future. And it's one of the most astounding sections in the book on time and eternity. But there's this incredible paragraph that is mind-bending. They talk about the experience we move through of moving through the universe into an eternal future, right? And so they're describing our development in eternity, and they say this is 1815, in the maturity of the developing self, the past and future are brought together to illuminate the true meaning of the present. I mean, this is exactly what Harry Seldon was doing, right? He was looking at all of the past, correlating and mathematically analyzing it, and then projecting present decisions that need to be made and their impacts as they would unfold in the future, right? And so they go on to say, as the self matures, it reaches further and further back into the past for experience, while its wisdom forecasts seek to penetrate deeper and deeper into the unknown future. And as the conceiving self extends this reach ever further into both past and future, so does judgment become less and less dependent on the momentary present. In this way, does decision action begin to escape from the fetters of the moving present, while it begins to take on the aspects of past future significance.
Wow.
And then they go on, they talk about the roundedness of time moving into eternity. But that paragraph is so, I mean, you're right, Andre. Asimov was, he was almost a prophet. And science fiction writers are foreseers of the future, really. They take and they project a reality that is imaginary, but that so often turns out to be exactly where we end up. And he was prescient. He really was.
Based on trajectory, right? It's the law of probability.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they're real students of that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that sounds like a great series. I might get Apple Plus just to see that one.
A lot of good things on there. But that alone was worth the price of admission. It was just so enjoyable to watch. They do a good job with it. Yeah.
What's your bringing up, Marvin? I'm sorry.
Oh, never mind. I just wanted to remind you to get off of mute if you were, so if you had something
to say. Something around here. Anyway, this what we're bringing up here, what you're bringing up, Mark, about this, the time units of maturity and how far into the past we can reach with our reckoning from experience reminds me of something I wanted to share last week, and I don't know if I did, but it has to do with the age of these beings. That were these descending suns that were created pretty much at the time of origin of the developing universe. So there's this paper I'm sure you're all familiar with, The Origin of Urantia, where they go through they talk about the Andromeda Nebula and how that was sort of the beginning of things for our local universe. And there, you know, they go through the whole time sequence going back in time. And in paper 57, section 3, paragraph 9, they get to 300 billion years ago, the Andromeda solar circuits were well established, and the nebular system was passing through a transient period of relative physical stability. About this time, the staff of Michael arrived on Salvington, and the Uversa government of Orbentan extended physical recognition to the local universe of Nebadon. So implied in there is that the architectural spheres, at least for the local universe capital, had been constructed. That part of the work had been done, and which took a long time in itself, of course. And then about that time, the staff of Michael arrived on Salvington. So I think we can kind of use that date as a marker for when the creation of these beings was undertaken by Michael and the Mother Spirit and Father Melchizedek, with the Melchizedeks and all of that, which kind of, you know, 300 billion years ago, that's a pretty big reach into the past. So, I mean, I see no way to avoid the, well, it needs to be avoided, but escape the suggestion or the idea is that here is that our Melchizedeks and the Verondedeks and the others, they're that old. They're like 300 billion years old because they were all created, you know, within a period of time back when the local universe was getting fired up. So you think about our Macaventa or Calligathia for that matter. The idea that they've been around for 300 billion years is kind of staggering in terms of the implication of what that would mean as far as the stretch and the reach of this quality of anticipation of the future that's rooted in an awareness of the past, you know, that whole concept of reaching in both directions. And
well,
their reach into the past is like beyond our comprehension.
Yeah, 300 billion years of accumulated experience. Can you imagine what kind of wisdom accrues after 300 billion years?
Knowledge of experience.
That's crazy. That's that's astounding to think about. Yeah,
I know, Marvin. You
what
didn't give us
say,
the reference. You didn't give us the reference of that wonderful quote you read. What is the reference on that one?
It's 118.15, paper 118, section 1, paragraph 5. Yeah, it's in the section.
Yeah, that old section.
Time
is great.
And eternity. Oh, it's astounding.
Time and eternity. Okay, I'm gonna read that. Dave was saying on the board how he's inspired now to go read section or part 3 of the book, and I said one part always inspires you to read another, and definitely want to read that paper again. Well, we're down to the last two minutes.
It's in the middle of a very complex paper, yeah. Go ahead, Andre.
Yeah, right.
Well, I just wanted to say that given that next week is there's only going to be two of us here, Paula, I'm wondering whether we skip a week on this and we take up the upcoming Wild Goose and try and get some Wild Goose people and emergent Christians on next week. That would allow the two of us to have a bit of a robust conversation if we could do it. Are you up for that, or do we need to call it a bye?
What two are going to be gone? Is it Marvin and Chuck?
Yeah.
I won't be here next week. Slackers.
Right.
They got family
stuff
and whatnot.
Yeah. That would be good, and or get Gabriel on. I wonder if Gabriel Rimberg would like to come on and talk to us about the Jesus Metaverse. That might be neat, too.
We might be able to do both.
So,
Yeah, 1 hour for one and 1 hour for the other. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's try to work on that.
Okay.
In the meantime, you guys have a great family vacation, both of you. Kiss the season. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, kiss the season, right, for holiday, for families.
We'll all be
to get
on
together.
And off various times. We'll prognosticate, we will not have a show the week that there is the summer study session in Oak Brook, Illinois. That will be the 23rd. We will not meet. And so we'll probably put a rerun on the air.
maybe the 16th, which is the Saturday just before the summer study session, maybe we could actually focus on that gathering and have Sue and or Tim Duffy or others who are planning the program, Macab, and come on and talk about the conference. That might be fun.
If somebody can organize that, perhaps. I know I'm going to be busier than a one-armed paper hanger.
I know how that is.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thanks, you guys. Have a wonderful 4th of July holiday with your loved ones. And thanks to our listeners. Love you guys so much. Good to see you today, Dee. Isadora, so wonderful always to see you. And
good
Vaughn,
to be with
thanks
you all.
For listening, brother. Yeah, good to be
Thank
with
you
all.
For listening.
And to all of our listeners on the archive. God bless you. Happy 4th.
Yeah.
Yeah,
until next we meet.
Hug. Have a good 4th.
Big hug.
I hope you had a good Canada Day, Perry. Our Canadians
yeah,
had Canada
right.
Day yesterday.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Okay.
Love you guys.
God bless
Love
you guys.
All.
Love
until
you.
Next time.
All right.
Bye for now.
See y'all soon.
Bye for now.
My name is Angie Thurston. I'm the Director of Formation for the Impact Lab at the On Being Project. In my work, I get to imagine the future of meaningful community and spirituality around the world. And the thing I'm most excited about right now is...
Goodness, we didn't have... Somehow things were not cute. Okay, that's what happened. Sorry about that, folks.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.